Call the House Committee on Health Care to order, and we'll open up a public hearing on HB 2535. We'll invite Representative Gelzer. This is Representative Gelzer Day in the Health Care Committee to talk about this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for the kindness of scheduling all of my bills on one day. For the record, I am Sarah Gelzer. I'm the state representative representing House District 16. In case you don't know, that includes Corvallis, Philomath, Oregon State University, Go Beavers, and two individuals who live in Linn County who I try very hard to represent. The first bill that you're hearing before you today is House Bill 2535, and this would create a prescription drug repository in the State Board of Pharmacy. The idea for this bill was submitted to me by a constituent of mine named Deanna Kingston, who will be here in just a couple of moments. She's out in the hallway. And this is what she told me, and this is why I've introduced this bill. A person suffers from a chronic disease. It is common for him or her to try a variety of costly treatments. A cancer patient may go through several treatment programs, often abruptly stopping a course of medications that is not working in order to try a new course of medications. In many cases, a patient has already bought several doses of prescribed medication when a course of treatment is abandoned. These medications may cost hundreds or thousands of dollars per dose, and because the treatment plan has changed, they therefore go unused and wasted. These well-insured patients are fortunate enough to be able to try several medications and find the right fit for their course of treatment. For the uninsured or the underinsured patient, even one dose of a prescribed drug may be costly enough to be out of reach of that individual. These underprivileged patients resign themselves to live as best they can without a medication that could actually save their lives. Representative Barton, who is sorry that he can't be here this afternoon, he's needed in another committee, but he has written testimony that is submitted to you. But Representative Barton and I introduced this bill at the request of a cancer survivor from Corvallis who experienced this waste firsthand. She met with a cancer support group regularly and talked about throwing drugs away, while other women talked about their lack of access to the exact same drugs. This bill would close the gap between these two types of patients and ensure that drugs do not go to waste if they are in demand. 37 states currently have a prescription drug repository, and 10 other state legislatures are currently considering adding similar programs. The details of the laws vary from state to state, but the overall goal is to allow the return of prescription drugs in single-use or sealed packaging from state programs, nursing homes, medical facilities, and individuals. I won't go through the details of the programs in other states, but I did submit information to the committee detailing the various programs around the country. My legislative aide, Chris Garo, has done a tremendous amount of work researching this and is a tremendous repository of information herself. I will also say that Chris has talked with several boards of pharmacy in other states, and all of them have reported success with the programs. I'd also like to assure the committee that this bill is in complete compliance with federal regulations relating to drug safety, and it has many safeguards to protect both the participating pharmacies and also the people receiving the drugs. This includes limiting the program only to drugs in their original, sealed, and tamper-evident packaging. Finally, I want to emphasize that this bill is 100% voluntary, so this is in no way a mandate on pharmacies or anybody else to participate. Furthermore, those that do choose to participate are allowed by the bill to charge a small handling fee to cover any costs associated with the program. As you know, this legislative session seems to be moving really, really quickly. And this bill was scheduled in the middle of last week. So I had the opportunity to meet last week with Gary Schabel of the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. He and my legislative aide, Chris Garo, have been working together over the course of the past week to gather more information about the experience of the pharmacy boards in the other states. I look forward to working with Mr. Schnabel and the Oregon Board of Pharmacy once their board has had the opportunity to formally review the bill. In the end, I think this bill represents an intriguing opportunity for each of us, particularly in this very difficult session. With so many Oregonians out of work and struggling with their medical costs, this is a concrete proposal that we can enact with very little, if any, impact on government expenditures. In a climate where we spend hours every day looking at the devastating cuts we must make to get through this biennium and the next, and imagining the real impact that has on real Oregonians, this is a proposal to which we can give a hearty endorsement and deliver real hope, real service, and real opportunity to people who need it today. Thank you again, Mr. Chair, for scheduling this bill so quickly and for giving it your full consideration, and I strongly urge your quick and early support of House Bill 2535. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, my only complaint was she didn't ask me to sign on the bill, but we'll
thank you, Representative Mayor. I note for the record, Mr. Chair, that you have some surly members of your committee that may be difficult to manage. I attempt to work with them at 1 p.m. and know three of them, in fact. We have lots of cross-population between health and education. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the members of the committee, the information that Representative Gelzer mentioned, there is attached behind the staff measure summary the report on, from NCSL on the state prescription drug and the other states that, and their program definitions and parameters.
Thank you, ma'am. Can I call Dina Kingston, please?
Hello. So I'm new at this.
If you please identify yourself.
Okay. Time. Well, I am Deanna Kingston, and I am an associate professor of anthropology at Oregon State University. Excuse me. And I'm also a breast cancer patient. I'm about 10 days post-breast reconstruction surgery myself. Yay. About a year ago, I found out from another woman who, blogs about her breast cancer experiences. Her name is Jean Sather, and she's in Seattle. She was discussing on her blog the amount of unused drugs that she ends up collecting over the course of her treatment. She's been a breast cancer patient for 10. This is my second round with breast cancer. She blogged about, she found out about these other drug repositories in other states, and I thought it was a great idea. Thank you. And I brought it to the attention of the local breast cancer support group in Corvallis, and I was pleasantly surprised by the amount of support that they gave. And so I started asking some of my colleagues at Oregon State, how would we go about getting such a program here in Oregon? And so they told me to contact Sarah Gelzer, so I did. And I was really pleasantly surprised at how quickly she jumped on the idea. I have a lot of, I'm not usually this nervous in front of my classroom. <I'm sure. laughs> It's any new speaking engagement.
The only difference is that in your classroom you have adult supervision.
Right. And there isn't any here. Oh, that's kind of scary.
And you're going to give us grades.
Exactly. Or tell a good boob joke. I collect boob jokes in case you are interested. Anyway, it's on my blog. But... So anyway, I thought it was a good idea. Members of my own family are underinsured or uninsured. My mom, for instance, cannot get hearing aids because neither Medicare nor her supplementary insurance pay for hearing aids. You know, my brother can't get some prescription drugs because he is uninsured, or he goes without. I realize how fortunate I am that I have not had to face that same situation where I can't get access to the drugs that I need. fortunately, I'm doing really well. I did have skin metastases and also some little metastases in my bone marrow. But I have had good insurance. I've been able to get access to the drug treatments that I need. I do have two prescriptions that I'm supposed to take that cost together almost $6,000 a month. Currently, because I'm doing so well, 7 months of good tumor markers and the PATH results after surgery have been really good. I have one in my cupboard. I have about $2,000 worth of drugs that I'm not able to use, but I just really tears me apart that no one else can use them either, because I know that there are a lot of women out there, other cancer patients too, who could use those drugs. I also had an open skin wound. I lost the tissue expander after radiation treatment in August. And so I had an open cavity in my chest, and that required a wound pump. They thought I might need to wear it for months. I only had to wear it for a week. But in the meantime, I ended up with a box of these sterile dressings that probably cost at least $1,000. They're sitting in my closet going unused now. So I would really urge you to support this bill, because, like I said, I've been fortunate, but I would love to be able to pass these on so that other people can use them and for them not to have to go into a landfill. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Any question, Professor Kingston? Thank you very much for coming.
Sure. Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Yep.
Can I call Gary Schnabel? Hello again.
Hello. Good morning? Afternoon, I guess, now.
Whatever.
I'm Gary Schnabel. I'm executive director for the Board of Pharmacy. I don't really have any dramatic or compelling testimony. I just, on behalf of the board, was here to beseech you for a little bit of time to work with Representative Giltzer on some of the language. We just saw it for the first time last week, so we're coming in a little bit late, but... the board has not taken a position on this. They haven't actually seen it yet, but they have discussed this type of program in the past, and I know that they are supportive of this type of program. The times we've discussed it, we sort of run into roadblocks with regulations and different issues, and just, you know, haven't gotten that far yet, and maybe with a push from the legislature in this bill, it would get us there. But there's a little bit of language challenge, I think, you know, that we'd like to look at.
Great. You're prepared to get on that?
Mr. Chair, yeah, members of the committee, I'm prepared to recommend to the board that this is as good or better than what they've talked about before, and if we can play with the language a little bit, I'm sure that they will. One of our board members is actually in Representative Giltzer's district, and I can't believe she would vote against her own representative.
I wish my constituents would. Any questions, Mr. Snow? Gary, thank you very much. Oops, I'm sorry.
One quick question.
Nice to him now.
How much regulation do we have to deal with from the federal level on this? I know there are FDA regulations on a lot of these situations. Can you identify any of the sticking points? Obviously, if other states are doing it, there's a way to get around it. But I would like to see this move forward quickly in government. Ease doesn't always mean tomorrow. But, you know, is this something we can handle within Oregon, or are we going to be tied up for an inordinate amount of time dealing with the feds?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson. Yeah, the issues with federal regulation revolve mostly around FDA requirements for misbranded or adulterated drugs that deal with storage and distribution kind of things. And I've reviewed several states' models, too, and spoke with my counterparts in other states, and Representative Giltzer mentioned, and with my experience, too, they all say that their programs are working well. Some had some problems in the beginning, but they all like the programs. The state of Louisiana has 11 outlets in the whole state, so it's not like a competitive thing, you know, that people are going to try and get ahead by doing this. It's definitely a charitable issue. They refer to them mostly as charitable pharmacies rather than repositories or a different name. That's what most of them are. But the issues around storage of the drug for you know, appropriate conditions for, that would lead to adulteration or contamination. It may be a challenge to deal with drugs coming back from an individual. Most of the other programs freely return drugs from nursing facilities or hospitals. Some have grants with manufacturers and wholesalers to actually get some drugs directly from them. But I think that, I don't think we're going to be bogged down for a long time. I think if we can deal with the issue of a pharmacist being able to look at the stuff and verify that it has not been contaminated, it's not adulterated or misbranded, I think that's the issue.
Paul, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
If we were to embark on this, and it sounds like there's no resistance, does the board have the authority or the manipulative power to make sure that we would set up a network that would be truly statewide, dealing with rural? I fear these kind of programs would be very popular in metropolitan Portland, but Christmas Valley might not be in a position to participate, and that would be a shame. Is there a way that we could regulate in or massage in really statewide significance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, I'm not real sure, but that's one thing we would have to look at, and I've heard you mention that before, and I talked with Howard Anderson, who's Executive Director of the North Dakota Board of Pharmacy. His state has these types of programs in rural areas, but they have lots of areas where there's no pharmacies for 100 miles. You know,
For anything.
And Representative Geltzer mentioned that the language that's in there says this is a voluntary program. Nobody would have to. So I suppose we would have to look at incentives of some sort. I don't know if we could require it. I'm not sure how we'd have to do that. But
one more follow-up.
Go ahead.
In reading the bill, it's my understanding the pharmacies could trade or move material from one to the other across the state. Is that your understanding, that we could exchange materials or share materials through the system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, do you mean the donated materials? I don't see anything in this language that would prohibit that. It does say, though, that the Board of Pharmacy will have to write rules to create some standards. So, you know, I suppose that would be one of the issues that was dealt with in those standards, too.
Yeah. That'd be another way to get things out to the rural area if there were, you know, some kind of a network where people knew what was available other places.
Yeah. Vice Chair?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I mean, you know, we're not talking about the bottle of Tylenol. It's really the high-value drugs. Are most of the high-value drugs in bubble packages, or not?
Mr. Chair, as a matter of my understanding is that they're not. A lot of the drugs dispensed to nursing facilities and residential long-term care facilities are in blister packs. Those don't tend to be the cancer drugs that were discussed earlier.
Well, yeah, this is somewhat off subject. This weekend, I went through three big bags, garbage bags, of, in this case, expired medications that come to our office, and I have to deal with them, and I don't throw them down the toilet. They end up going into our hazardous waste biohazard. But it has always stunned me over the years of how many drugs are, in fact, wasted. And we get patients all the time that bring us back a bottle of whatever and say, can you give this to someone else? And we say, no, we can't, but we will dispose of it for you. And you know, I am quite surprised that we don't have it, and it hasn't been an issue or brought up before, and we need to figure it out.
Yeah, I was going to share my experience. As many of you know, I'm a survivor from lymphoma, and for a long period I was using an injectable once a week to try and boost my hematocrit, and it was $300 a pop, and it came four bottles, each individually labeled, I mean four injectable 30 cc bottles, let's say about $300 a pop, And somewhere along the line, my hematocrit seemed to be slipping a little, so I said to the doctor, what should I try? He said, well, why don't you try some iron, which I think maybe I should have tried first. But anyway, I took the iron, and the crit went back up. And there I was in my refrigerator with $600 worth of a drug that somebody could have used. And it really, I just thought, I mean, I really felt so frustrated. In fact, I think it's still in the refrigerator, but let's hurry up and pass this.
The iron cost just $3.
Hmm?
The iron cost about $3, I suppose.
Not quite that much. In this yeah, it turned out on the long run to be an important cost saver. But, that just seems so odd to happen. We need to find some way to do something about it.
Could I comment, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Yeah, members of the committee, in regards to that, the return drugs from nursing facilities in Oregon could be problematic to this bill because in our state, board regulations allow drugs that were dispensed in sealed containers to the nursing home that were maintained in the possession of the nursing staff and returned to the pharmacy could be reused for their regular inventory. So they might not be real excited to donate that if they can use it in the real
inventory. Well, then I assume they wouldn't.
Unless they were charitably inclined, and they might. So people might have to get creative about where they could get their drugs, but this legislation would allow them to do that. And maybe they could get grants from various places that would donate stuff. You need to be careful that these programs don't become dumping grounds for somebody that has short-dated material and just wants to get rid of it.
You don't want that.
But I think we can fix all that stuff and make this move.
Representative Thompson, would you work with Representative Gelser and Mr. Schnabel?
I would be honored.
See if we can get this stuff in shape. Does that work all right for you, Representative Gelser?
Yes.
Good. Thank you.
You know, the other comment about the short-dated stuff, it's going somewhere. And if it's not going in someone's garbage can and up in the landfill, I mean, the best places for this stuff to end up is with their healthcare provider or pharmacist, because we have a path to deal with the destruction of it.
Yeah, and maybe short.
We're going to talk about that one too before we're done.
Oh,
yeah, I think it's going to be an issue.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
We passed out written testimony that's submitted from Representative Barton. You have a half a sheet of written testimony for the record, and then you also have testimony from Lucy Noon that is speaking on an individual perspective, but it comes from the Benton Hospice Service and provides you additional perspective of support.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll close the hearing on HB 2535 and open the first public hearing on HB 2452. Madam Administrator, would you give us a brief comment on it, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2452 comes to you at the request of Representative Gelser on behalf of Chris Chapman. For the old-timers on the committee, you might remember this bill. We had it. It was House Bill 3331 last session. It's establishing a personal income tax credit for individuals donating certain transplanted organs during a tax year. It limits credit to be lesser of 50% of the personal income tax liability or $5,000. This applies. This has a date starting on or after January 1, 2010, and then it would and to be used before January 1, 2015. This has a subsequent referral to revenue. And what's in his hair, Mr. Chair?
Thank you. Chris Gelser, you want to try the first shot on this? And then we'll call Chris Chapman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from Corvallis and Philomath, and I'm very pleased to bring to you House Bill 2452, which would provide a little bit of assistance to those very generous people who offer their organs to others so that they can live. We did have this bill last session. We passed it out of the Healthcare Committee, we passed it out of the Revenue Committee, and we passed it off of the House floor, and then we adjourned sine die. This is the fourth
session that this bill has been around, and so hopefully this time may in fact be the charm. The difference in this bill from last time is that it addresses a concern that was raised in both the Healthcare Committee and the Revenue Committee last time, which was that the assistance was too meager. In the prior bill, the reimbursement was capped at $1,000. And what these expenses are intended to cover are the medical and lost wage expenses that an individual voluntarily undertakes when they do make that very altruistic choice to sacrifice a part of their body for another person. The tax credit would only apply to living organ donors, so basically you're talking about a kidney or a partial liver. The tax credit is not intended to cover all of the costs that are related to donating an organ for the donor. And talking with organ donation advocacy organizations, that was very important because, after all, the giving of an organ is an altruistic activity, and that's why people do it. I introduced this bill last session at the request of Chris Chapman, who is here to talk with you. I had the great privilege of working with Chris Chapman in my office last year. She has worked tirelessly on this bill and came to support it and understand it because she herself has made that tremendous sacrifice of sharing a piece of herself with someone that she cared about very much, and has worked tirelessly to make that easier for other people so that that same sacrifice can be made for others. I hope that you will consider this bill, send it on to the Revenue Committee early so that maybe we don't run out of time this time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we get a revenue impact statement? Well, since it's going there, we don't have to have that in advance of that, is that right?
No, Mr. Chair, I do have the revenue impact statement from last session, but seeing as how this is slightly different, it may not. But they'll give us a relative, what they call a hall pass, that might have some sort of a range that this committee can get a sense of before they actually do the full revenue.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, it was a relatively limited revenue impact because you're looking at a relatively limited universe of individuals that are donating their organs.
You remember how many that was from our last year's, roughly?
106, I'm hearing from behind me.
Oh, something tiny.
Oh, Mr. Chair, it's in the background on the staff measure summary as well.
Okay. Is that what it says?
Well, it says on average roughly 90 each year.
Right.
Yeah. And there is, so from the 07 session, it was minimal for 07-08, topping out at $100,000 for 09-11. Again, this is a little bit bigger.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I do have a question, which is, Representative Gelser, I think it's limited to single kidney or partial liver. I understand the need to define it somehow. Do you recall why, out of the universe of possible transplants, it's limited to certain ones?
Yes, thank you, Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon. The idea behind that was that in terms of organs, what you could contribute as a living organ donor would be a kidney or a partial liver. We didn't want to go down the road of bone marrow transplants because that would really broaden the universe, and particularly in this budget cycle, maybe make it unreachable for us. And certainly the recovery time and the medical costs that are associated with particularly a kidney donation are pretty substantial.
Good. Representative Bruin, would you like to comment on this? As a
you were waiting for me to do my living heart donor joke about Ron Mauer and Republicans on this one.
Well, no, but that would be a bonus.
Mr. Chair, as it was well described, this bill came up, and it was a lesser dollar amount, but it came up 2007, as Representative said. It was a good idea then. It's an even better idea now. It's something that I felt very strongly about for a long time, and I'm very happy that Representative Gelser asked me to co-sponsor or to sign on to this bill as well, and I remain a very active supporter because I think people like Ron Mauer ought to have a benefit for donating their heart.
Well, I think he needs
it. And we may need to amend the bill to include, you know, Ryan.
He could use a more progressive
And Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, first of all, I would just simply acknowledge that I will make my best efforts to bring to Representative Maurer a bill that he can sign on to. Secondly,
I bring one that he's willing to support.
Oh. I also realize that I failed to mention the chief co-sponsor of this bill is Representative Bailey, who is not able to be here this afternoon. He asked me to bring you his apologies and to express on his behalf his support for this bill.
Thank you very much. Can we hear from Chris Chapman, please? Representative Thompson, do you want to take a courtesy of the committee break while we... Does anybody want to introduce to us here today?
Well, I guess I could take you.
That smiling face.
I have my grandson here today from Fresno, who's be staffing my office for a couple of days.
Uh-huh.
And he is, this is the second committee he sat in on. Ways and Means, he made it through 20 minutes.
I made it through a little longer.
Which I found long because I was planning on leaving before he did. But he will be here for a while, and I assume that he may disappear at some time. But this is a learning curve.
Welcome to the committee, and welcome to Oregon. It's a much nicer place than California. Please.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Chris Chapman, and I live at 2451 Southeast Yamhill in Portland. I want to thank you for this opportunity to address the committee in support of my bill, HB 2452, quote, establishes personal income tax credit for individuals donating certain transplanted organs during the tax year, end quote. While that certainly rattles off the tongue, I prefer to call it the Oregon Kidney Plan, or OKP. This is my fourth time with this idea. Last session, it passed the Health Care Committee, the Revenue Committee, and the House by a vote of 48-2. Was in the Senate at the time of adjournment, as we've already discussed here. My concept is simple. It's a tax credit for a living donation of a kidney or a partial liver. This is a small way to support the donors, and it means one less thing that they would worry about while they recover. 20 states have similar laws. Wisconsin was the first in January of 2004 with AB 477. The sponsor, then State Representative Steve Weichart, Republican from Appleton, said, quote, no one, rich or poor, would receive any additional money for donating. All they would do is lose less money, end quote. The fiscal impact statement from last session, like we were just talking about, had the cost at under $50,000, which is a relatively small amount in terms of the state budget. I know it will go up because we've raised the minimum dollar amount. However, no matter what price tag we put on it, the amount the state foregoes for this one-time tax credit can be replaced by returning a sick person, the recipient, to a full and productive life. I believe the state would make their money back many times over. People smarter than me have said, quote, the true economic cost is the loss in well-being and income that the donors incur. The tax credit is simply a cost-sharing transfer, end quote. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chris, I have one. Was there a thought to limit this to non-relative donations?
No. I actually came at this with no limits. I would actually like to see more than just kidneys and partial livers, but as a starting place, we wanted to start with something that was actually doable. Other than that, I want it to be as broad and as wide open as possible. Okay. So,
any other questions?
Well, another comment, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you again for bringing this year. And I think the point that you made and that Representative Gelser made just bears repeating again and again and again, that the tax credit being looked at in this bill in no way covers the cost,
right.
Both certainly the monetary cost, but the cost in time and change in life and everything that goes with that. So I just think that's a point that bears repeating. Mr. Chair, to your point about limiting it to non-relatives, is interesting. Coincidental, I was at a basketball game for my daughter, my 10-year-old daughter, on Saturday, and it happens to be it's a church league. And during the halftime, they have a little testimony. And the testimony that was given just this last Saturday was a wife, a person I'd never met before, but in front of an audience, and giving testimony about a few years back that she had her husband was dying of kidney failure, and they were compatible for kidneys, and so she had donated her kidney to her husband, and everything is working great. And I don't remember how many years ago, but it was wonderful. And so I think that you know, there's a family that obviously you know, has given a lot and suffered a lot, and I think it's entirely appropriate for a family to be able to benefit as well as non-family. So,
yeah, kidneys are particularly important on the healthcare side because the alternative to that is staying on dialysis for a long, long time, which is
a lot of money,
very expensive, and very difficult.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, part of the thinking behind this is to reward those people who make this sacrifice. But I would assume part of the thinking is also to create an incentive for those, for people to do it who might not, under the current law, without the existence of this, and looking at the lost income and cost associated with it, might not make the sacrifice. It might be helpful as we move forward this to hear about the need for donors. I'm assuming that there is unmet need, and I think there is.
That
would be an interesting and I think helpful piece to add as we, you know, move forward advocating for this proposal.
Perhaps we can refer to it rather than as increasing the incentive, reducing the disincentive.
Yeah, right. Right.
Yeah, no, seriously. Yeah. Because it's sort of, I mean, that is always a criticism. You don't want to create a financial reason.
Just making it an easier decision for people to make.
Yeah, that's important.
And I personally, I just wanted to do something for those donors, and I wanted it to be big enough that it was more than a nickel, you know? I didn't want to give, you know, you can't even buy a cup of coffee for a dollar anymore. So I wanted it to be enough that it was something substantial, but not so much. I mean, I'm not trying to wipe out anybody's tax bill. I want to give them credit for that year, which would have been a difficult year for them. I want them to have a little bit less in expenses, and by paying less taxes, they can spend that money on their transportation and their lodging and the other things that they need to do. So at the bottom of my testimony, I put two websites. And the first one tells you about the 20 other states and the kind of laws like this that they have. The second one, where I labeled it People Smarter Than Me, Representative Cannon, it's a wonderfully complex document where some folks did their homework tremendously. I could never even attempt to do what they did, but they do it. That's one of the issues that they address in that article. They tried to quantify the amount of the tax credit, just sort of averaging it out. And so, anyway, I didn't want to get into too many specifics here. I wanted to keep it light and easy and quick. But there's a lot more data on that. Personally, I have no problem if it was my husband giving to me and he got a tax credit. I have no problem with that. I have no problem with that in other families. If that was something we thought we might want to limit, I'm okay with that as well.
That was just I would like on your mind.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of ways we could do this, and I would just like to see the most broad application that we could have to start with.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely, thank you.
You can buy a cup of coffee for less than a dollar on the fourth floor.
And actually, I can buy a refill for 95 cents wherever, but you know, it's the general statement there.
Chris, thank you very much.
Absolutely, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
I'll check in with the chair of the Revenue Committee and get some sense on how.
My state representative, Copal Bailey, is one of the vice chairs there, too. So he's already aware that this bill is coming there.
Good.
And hopefully he'll be helpful to
you. Always good to work with your own representative.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 245. Oops.
House Bill.
I'm sorry. How'd that happen? On House Bill 2452. And open up the first public hearing on House Bill 2445. Representative Gelser.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It may surprise you to learn that my name is Sarah Gelser. I am the state representative from Corvallis and Philomath, which is House District 16. I do. I miss this committee. This is a fun committee.
Oh, yeah.
Except when we're surly.
Except when you're surly.
Oh, yeah.
But this is a big ask, so you all look very unsurly right now. You all look very open. House Bill 2445, I was just pondering how great it is that Chris Chapman is in the room, because 2 years ago she was instrumental in orchestrating a very large hearing that we had when this bill used to be called House Bill 2407. This was the second part of a pair of bills that I called last session the Welcome Home Package, and I thank all of you who were here last time for helping, and I think Representative Maurer was a co-sponsor of House Bill 2406, which we, and many of you were actually, that we passed into law that created a medically involved waiver that allowed children with significant disabilities to be able to grow up in their family home and have in-home care. That waiver was capped at 150 in its full implementation. So the companion bill that went along with that is this bill, which would allow Oregon to participate in the federal Family Opportunity Act. And the Family Opportunity Act was passed a couple of years ago after about a decade of work by Senator Kennedy and others who recognize the tremendous financial burdens that come from raising a child with special health care needs. The problem isn't that these families don't have insurance. To the contrary, they do. They experience a very different challenge, which is underinsurance. If you have a child who is never going to outgrow their diapers, but instead will just need more diapers and bigger diapers, if you have a child that from early childhood is in a wheelchair, you'll quickly find that their wheelchair, they outgrow it, and it needs to be replaced at a different schedule and a different rate than an adult's wheelchair, which is what insurance policies are based on. You will find that these families need supports for in-home care, that they may exhaust their outpatient mental health benefits, their inpatient mental health benefits, additional drugs and medications, and of course, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy. There are a lot of these families in the state of Oregon. If you think about the universe of children with special health care needs, it's a broad universe. It includes kids with physical disabilities, developmental disabilities, chronic illness, and mental health. If you look at just a small subset of that, we have 12,000 Oregon children with developmental disabilities, and that is a narrow population. In the context of this bill, we anticipate there may be about 2,900 kids between 100 and 300% of the federal poverty level that would have the opportunity to benefit from this bill. Not all of them would do so because not all of them need more than what their insurance offers. So let me quickly tell you exactly what this bill does, and then I want to make a pitch for why it's important. And behind me are a lot of people who live this every day that can tell you how much they would like to continue raising their children at home, how they don't want to have to get a divorce just to be able to afford to keep their kids at home, how they don't want to have to be forced to place their kids in foster care or nursing homes, and how they would like to be able to start accepting raises and promotions and stop artificially impoverishing themselves and keeping their family income voluntarily below the Medicaid level simply so that they can have access to Medicaid for their children so that they can keep them at home. This bill would allow families to pay a premium to buy into Medicaid as a supplement to their private insurance. There is cost sharing. All of the families would pay a premium, and they would be required to maintain the private insurance that they already have. Their private insurance would continue to pay for everything that the private insurance will pay for, and often this is their surgeries, their major medications, and other items. What this would pick up for them, durable medical equipment, diapers, wheelchair replacement, and one of the most important things, because it's a Medicaid benefit, in the state of Oregon, we have a 20 hours of personal care benefit that would allow someone to come in 20 hours to help with bathing and lifting and moving. And this is really important as children get bigger and older. For many of us who have kids with disabilities, I have a child with a disability. Many of you have met him today. He's now bigger than I am, but still requires full assistance every day with showering and brushing his teeth and getting dressed.
That's heavy, but he can help. Other kids who don't have as much freedom of use of their limbs as my son does require their family members to be doing full lifting, and having access to someone to come in and support them is very helpful. The lack of this underinsurance becomes even more difficult because Oregon, sadly, despite our best intentions and despite great people that work at the Department of Human Services, is one of the least friendly states in the nation to live if you have a child with a disability. We have very few programs that are available to them. We have a small general fund only family support program, which does offer some support with things like respite care and home modifications. But we have more kids that are out of that system than are in. It serves right now only about 1,100 children, and there are over 2,500 additional children on the waiting list, and this is not one of the programs that's on our list for reductions this session as we go through our budget cuts. For many of these families, that is the only thing that's eligible to them, with an average of about $250 of assistance over the course of a year. We knew another family. I want to tell you briefly about two families in my district alone. You have these families in your districts as well. The first is a little girl named Kenzie, and her family was going to come and testify about this 2 years ago, and unfortunately Kenzie passed away about a week before our hearing. But her mother came anyway because it was that important to her. And she described her son, who at the time must have been 9 or 10 years old, who drew a picture of this problem for their family. On one side was their family with all of the siblings and the child. On the other side were the medical services that they needed. In the middle was this giant cliff. It was like two mountains. And he said, "We have to figure out how we get to the other side without falling in." For a child of that age to recognize the depth of that need and the tremendous risk that was there was extraordinary. And in fact, in this family, the individual worked with my husband. Every year, they had to go and adjust his salary increases, because if it increased too much, they would lose access to her SSI eligibility, which would mean they would lose access to her medical card, which would mean to keep her alive, they would have had to release custody of her into foster care or a nursing home, which would have been much more expensive for us than this program. The other one, and this story is a little bit harder for me to tell, and this mom has given me permission to share this. Many of you who were co-sponsors of this bill were part of a press conference to kick this off. And joining us was a family, a woman named Shauna and her daughter Hannah. She's a single mom, and Hannah has a brother. And she talked about how she, too, has to turn down her raises every year. She works at Oregon State University. And how important this bill would be to allowing her to be able to take the compensation that she is earning, keep her daughter at home, and still be able to offer her son the opportunities that he needed. And she talked just about how important that was. About a year ago, and it was about a day before I was leaving, I was invited to go and speak about this to the American Maternal and Child Health Program National Conference. She called right before I left for that to let me know that the day before she had to release Hannah into foster care because it was no longer possible for her to meet Hannah's needs and to meet her son's needs while forcing herself to live in poverty to maintain access to that medical care. So Hannah today is living in foster care, and what Shauna said to me on the phone, and these are her exact words, "It is the breaking of my mother's heart that I have to let go of my child in order to keep her alive." These are the absolutely devastating choices that hundreds of families in Oregon face every day. This is one of the reasons why we have hundreds of Oregon children with special health care needs that live in foster care, which is much more expensive than what this program would cost us. Some people would say that the most pressing issue before us that we need to solve first is the issue of those who are uninsured, and I agree that we absolutely must address that problem. But if you are underinsured to the degree that you can no longer live in your home with your family, that you have to go to foster care or a nursing home, that you have to watch your parents get divorced, or the rest of your family must choose to live in poverty, I would argue that you really don't have much of anything, that insurance isn't doing you a lot of good. It's my hope that you will consider rolling this program into House Bill 2009. I think this is a critical piece of healthcare reform that looks at the unique needs that a very niche but large population has. It is something that will reduce the number of kids that we have in foster care. It will pull some of these families off of our Medicaid rolls because they'll be able to take jobs that give them private insurance for the rest of their families. It will help them move off of TANF and food stamps and other public assistance programs because we will not be forcing them to live in poverty just because they love their children so much that they want to do what you and I take for granted, which is to raise our children in our homes until they become adults. So thank you very much for taking the time to hear this testimony. It is a very important bill. It's something that's very close to my heart. It's something that I believe that we can do within the scope of healthcare reform. I think it's something we have a moral obligation to do because at the end of the day, I think every single one of us can agree the best thing we can give to a kid is their family. No child should lose their family because of a medical insurance issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Gelter. Other questions?
Can I just comment, Mr. Chairman? Thank you, Representative Gelser. Just a comment that, and this is a good example of what we see in so many areas of public assistance, which is the highest marginal tax rate in the world is paid by that family whose next dollar of income takes them off or out of the assistance they need.
Representative Gelser, what happens to these kids when they become 19?
When the children become 19, they are no longer, their eligibility no longer counts on their parents' income, so they do become Medicaid eligible.
On their own.
The problem that they have is that their family income is counted with their parents. And what you'll hear, I believe that Catherine White will have submitted to you a packet, or she will, of really heartbreaking testimony. And there's one in there where a person talks about, we make too much to qualify for any help. We make too little to provide for what our child needs. We truly have fallen through the crack. And when that child hits 19, we will cover them on Medicaid for the full benefit. This is just a wraparound benefit.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Just a comment. Is it possible we could invite Representative Gelser back once a week? It's refreshing to get a discrete package of bills that we can actually do something about that help people. And maybe if she could keep them coming, you know.
Careful what you ask.
Let's make sure we do these for her.
Okay.
Representative Thompson, will you repeat that at our next town hall when people are angry with me?
I might do that.
So it means when they turn 19, they stay home. I mean, they stay home where they are, and they're now eligible for Medicaid, correct?
Correct.
When they turn 19.
When they turn 19, they will be eligible for Medicaid and other services because this is the thing. These families will be responsible for the care of their children for their entire lives. These kids, these parents are not going to outgrow the responsibility for consistent 24-hour care for these kids. They're going to be caring for these kids when they're 20, when they're 30, when they're 40, when they're 60. We provide help to them after they turn 19, but I think because we generally have that sense that in a community, parents are responsible for their children, it's, well, everybody's responsible for their children. You should be responsible for yours. These are extraordinarily responsible people, many of whom go a week at a time without sleeping, and all they're asking for is a little bit of help to get through that first 19 years so that maybe they can have a little bit of energy to get through the next 50.
This is a huge problem. I've dealt with it four or five times now, and this, by the way, is one of the reasons that we get wrapped up in these cases where we're transporting a child to school every day in an ambulance, because that's a program that does work. We can transfer the cost of helping out to the school districts, but we can't cover it through any other kind of more sensible program, and I'm 100% behind what the representative is saying. This is it's a tragedy in all of our communities of families that are just beaten to death with a child that needs these kinds of services, and there's no logical way to get them.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Can we have Catherine wait first, and then we'll bring up some other panels?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Catherine White, and I'm with the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. And I won't repeat Representative Gelser's very eloquent testimony. This is an issue that we are very, very familiar with. It is the issue of underinsurance, not just uninsurance, for families who have kids with disabilities. As Representative Gelser mentioned, we have a couple waivers currently, Medicaid waivers, that ignore parental income, that allow families access to Medicaid services. They're very limited. The eligibility criteria is very, very high. They are not at the legal cap is 200 for each of these waivers. They are not at that capped level. They're not funded for that capped level, and the eligibility criteria is so high. Oregon simply does not have a safety net that many states currently have. They have broader programs that help pick up the medical needs of many of the families. We just do not have that safety net. What I've included in my testimony is just some data from the survey on children with special health care needs. Oregon is not unique in terms of the number of children with special health care needs, but as you can look at some of the data, and it's on the back of the testimony, we are high in some of those areas. Numbers of families who are without insurance at some point during the year. The access to specialty care. And I think one of the significant ones is the number of kids who miss days of school due to illness, and the number of families who've had to stop work or cut back on their work in order to care for their kids. We hear a lot of that. I also included, and Representative Gelser referenced, some of the stories that families have shared with us in 2000 and then later in 2009. We checked back with many of these families to see where things were. And the situation for many of them has gotten more difficult, more challenging, as insurance policies that they may have had start contracting. The challenges continue out there. I would be happy to answer any questions. I think we certainly would support any effort to figure out how this could fit in the health care reform activities that are going on.
Thank you. Any questions? There are... We're looking in this case for the waiver for a special program. Is that right? We're looking to match that.
Mr. Chair, yes. This is a special waiver.
It's there for us. Said there are 10 of them or something available? Or that?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure of the exact number of family opportunity waivers that have actually been granted at this point.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Brian Temple and Christy Sakai, please, to the... Is there anybody else intending to testify to this that hasn't signed on yet? Other than the people that have already signed on.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for having me here. My name is Brian Temple. I'm a local pediatrician at Childhood Health Associates of Salem. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2445. As Representative Gelser did mention, this bill does help create a financial model that helps families obtain and cover medical costs associated with raising a child with special needs. Children with special needs is a broad definition and includes a great number of children diagnoses including devastating neurological disorders, cerebral palsy, hearing and vision impairment due to lack of oxygen in utero, including inherited disorders of metabolism and storage diseases, and brain malformations and organ malfunction. These are just to mention a few, and every day in my clinic I see at least one, and on a weekly basis, monthly basis, a handful. And our clinic is known to care for a great deal of the special needs kids in Salem and throughout Oregon, for that fact. A lot of them come to see Dr. Lace or myself. As Representative Geltzer did mention, she did wonderfully. She took most of my speech, but she hit on every point I wanted to. It's a very important bill that really needs to be considered and passed, because these children essentially will never be able to take care of themselves, and basically activities of daily living will require an extensive medical care and cost to keep them living. Daily necessities like diapers, urinary catheters, feeding tubes, special diets, special beds all cost a lot of money, and even with insurance, these parents are taking a lot out of pocket. And like she mentioned, having a difficult time turning down jobs or salaries or increases in order to maintain their lower level of income. And I have two children myself, and I'm fortunate enough that I am going to be able to watch my children outgrow the use of diapers. But as she mentioned, a lot of kids with special needs are going to end up wearing diapers the rest of their life, and they will only get more expensive and bigger. So it's a difficult time for not only the family, but also the children involved. And through no fault of their own, these children do place a tremendous burden on their families. The emotional burden alone is devastating. In many cases that I've seen in my practice or have read about in journals, the amount of marital discord and divorce is unbelievable. It seems to occur on a weekly basis in our clinic. When we say, what's going on with you, you're doing the little social history, something is changing, either job loss, marital problems, or just family problems in general. It's well evidenced in journals and research that families of special needs do have a greater likelihood of ending up in divorce or more economic hardship. And additionally, they pose a financial burden, not only for the family, the state, and everyone in these hard times financially. We know what's going on in the news. It does seem to be difficult to deal with, but it's something that's essential. These kids do need to be taken care of, and these families need to be taken care of, or else what happens is they end up losing their jobs, they end up in bankruptcy, and one way or the another they end up in government assistance, whether through foster care or through another program to help them, which there aren't many established. So House Bill 2445 establishes a system to allow working families to buy health insurance for their special needs child. And as Representative Geldner put it, it does make it affordable not only for the families to keep their children healthy and provide them with the durable needs, but also to sustain, hopefully in the long term, their marriage and their own financial cost in the family. Special needs children are, I would say, the most vulnerable in our society, both medically, physically, socially, and something needs to be done to help them out. And hopefully this bill will help do that in a cost-effective manner. As a society, as a legislator, as a committee, as a pediatrician, we all, I feel, have a moral obligation to help these children and figure out a way to get them the basic medical care they need. So passage of this bill does require and courage from the members of the legislature and specifically this committee in order to help these families not go bankrupt or end up in divorce. So I ask, and I know a lot of parents, and you'll hear from some now, will ask that you vote in favor of this bill. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Temple. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
I guess that's me. Hand me those tissues. I don't know what's going to happen. Thanks.
Take a deep breath.
Okay. Hi, my name is Christy Sakai, and I live at 33449 Highway 228 in Halsey. And I'm the parent of three children with autism. Ours is a unique story because we have multiple children with disabilities, but it reflects the stories of countless families I've spoken to across the state. Prior to June of 2000, we mistakenly believed we had excellent insurance coverage through my husband's work. However, that myth was dispelled after the insurance company approved a referral for our son, Tom, our oldest, to be for an evaluation by a developmental pediatrician. And when the result came back that he had autism, they denied payment. They informed me they excluded coverage of autism. So we did not know when we were going in that's what they were going to say, but once they said autism, that slammed the door for us. Up until that time, my husband and I would have been characterized as fiscally responsible. We didn't carry any debt besides our mortgage. We live frugally not only within our needs, but below our means. We had excellent credit. We drove cheap cars rather than taking a car loan. We never carried a credit card balance, and we had a big fat savings account. But that seems like a distant memory now. Because when the insurance company refused to cover evaluations and therapy for Tom, my husband and I were determined to help our son regardless of the sacrifice, financial or otherwise. This is a pretty significantly impaired kid, but it didn't really show up until third kid and we didn't know what we were looking at. So we paid out of pocket for Tom's treatments and we emptied our savings. And then we made an agonizing decision to use credit to cover treatments. Because after all, how can you not get treatment for your child when they need it? And there were so many other expenses that we couldn't have even guessed, medication and doctors that were not covered by insurance. I sat down and tallied our expenses in an 18-month period once, and it was $17,000. What we couldn't have known is that within 4 years, all three of our children would be diagnosed with autism, and we've never had any kind of financial security since then. Although our sons Tom and Kidor eventually approved for SSI and therefore became eligible for Medicaid, our daughter Kaida was not. After she was diagnosed in 2004, Social Security deemed her disabled, but not disabled enough. And by the way, this is a kid who can't be in general ed, who has bathroom issues. She requires total care. She requires constant supervision and care. She cannot be in a bathtub by herself because she has epilepsy and can drown. We hung in there, managed to get by as best we could with private insurance, but we were about to go from the frying pan into the fire. In December of 2006, my husband became extremely ill, and while in private short-term disability, he was terminated by his employer of nearly 17 years. Because of pre-existing conditions, our family could not get any other insurance but COBRA. In order to pay for it, we had to cash out my husband's 401k. The first year, COBRA cost us $1,190 per month. In the last 6 months, it was $1,270. And that's before we count the medical expenses we're already paying. When COBRA coverage ended, we switched to portability, which cost us $800 a month, but there was a $2,500 deductible, which means until we paid $2,500, of course, we're on our own. And our daughter, it costs $270 every time we walk in the neurologist's office. Her medication ran at least $200 a month. And again, this is all with insurance. Co-payments, EEGs, so many things that were not covered. Regular blood tests for her medications. We were living on the edge, nearly drowning in debt, unable to pay our bills, ultimately, and living in a constant state of fear. I can't convey to you what it's like to be worried in the middle of the night, sitting there scared, thinking, what if I can't pay my daughter's insurance? What if I can't pay for the neurologist? What if I can't keep our insurance and we won't be able to pay for her medication? It was a very difficult day when we had to seek assistance from a food bank because I had to choose between paying our insurance and buying groceries. No family should ever have to choose whether they can feed our children or make sure that they have the medical care that they need. Finally, after applying three times for our daughter for SSI, she was finally approved. And by the way, it's so hard. People say just apply for SSI, but there's so much documentation required. There's so much time involved. It's very hard for families to do that when they're caring for a child with special needs. In January of this year, Social Security approved my daughter for SSI. And when I got that letter, I fell to the floor and cried with relief because I knew my daughter would be covered. It was almost the end of the month, and I was sweating, like, how am I going to pay for her medication copayments? She's now eligible. It's true that we're so far financially under that I can't imagine that we can ever recover. Our children are below age of 18, and even when I am going to graduate school online, trying to hope for a better future for ourselves. So I do that at night while my children are sleeping. But I don't know how we are going to manage that, because when I work, will I make too much for them to qualify? I can't make too much for them to be booted off of insurance, because there's no way I can possibly pay to cover them, cover the expenses for their medication. So I'm testifying today not just merely to share our story, because, you know, I think we're pretty resilient. We've been through a lot. But there's so many families. I mean, we're going to be okay now. We have our kids are covered, but there's so many families who are not. And so I please implore you to support the Family Opportunity Act. Thank you. And these are my children. It's an old picture. I wanted to find when they are hugging and not, you know, bopping each other on the head. Do you have any questions?
That was a wonderful testimony. It's very important to hear these kind of stories, because we're here dealing with things in a general way, and making sure we see the faces that go behind these stories are very, very important to our process.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any questions? Thank you very much for coming, Ms. Lyon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Why don't you leave that picture there right now?
You want to see my kids?
Yeah, just leave it there. Pick it up when we're done. Thank you. Cheryl Grabham, William Ware is that, perhaps? And Tina Kitcher. That's going to be a tough act to follow.
Yeah. Well, now I know why people bring pictures instead of their kids, as you've seen. I've been.
Well, no, kids are much more effective.
Next time we might bring a picture. Okay. So, Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Grabham. I live at 4007 Northeast Skidmore in the Beaumont neighborhood of Northeast Portland. And I'm here to support House Bill 2445 because our daughter, Ren, is 3, and she has been diagnosed in the last year with spinal muscular atrophy, and that's a muscular dystrophy of sorts. So she has a progressive muscular disease, which thankfully will only impact her legs. But it has made a tremendous impact on our family. I grew up in Portland, but we've been living in Alaska for about 11 years. After her diagnosis, we moved to Portland to be near my family. What that meant, though, was giving up the state Medicaid program that we had in Alaska that covered all types. It's a similar legislation, and it covers respite, which parents desperately need, and equipment and other important things. So I'll just briefly tell you about our family. And why this is important to us. Currently, one parent needs to stay home to take care of Ren. She, you know, it's not safe for her to be unassisted in any kind of environment. And although she desperately wants to go to school, she can't do that until she gets a wheelchair. The wheelchairs that we're currently looking at are run between $10,000 and $30,000. And although I work and we have what I would consider to be very good private insurance, that's a stretch for a family with two kids to have one parent working and then additionally purchase this kind of equipment. We need to choose between very needed upgrades to our home, and not even including making it accessible for a wheelchair, and purchasing the equipment that she needs. And additionally, in this economic environment, if I am laid off from my job, then she won't have access to the insurance at all. And so so there's that piece. But then also, we're very fortunate. We both have master's degrees and could both be working if we could figure out how to have our daughter be in a safe environment. But in that situation, for families like us, we don't currently qualify for the low-income programs, but there's no way we can pay for all these things just out of pocket. And so this type of legislation would be it would be like night and day for our family. It would give us the break that we need in order to spend a little bit of time doing something fun as a family, versus always just working so hard. And we're willing to work hard, you know, to make it happen for our daughter, but this type of legislation would make it so that all of our hard work got us somewhere. So I just wanted to thank you for your consideration. This bill would help our daughter reach her full potential and become an independent person. So thanks.
Any questions? Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you, Chairman Greenlick, members of the Human Services Committee, and I apologize for having given you my rough notes on my testimony here today. I hope I will clarify any confusion I caused. My name is William Ware. I am an Oregon resident, a writer, and an attorney, and a recently retired Oregon forest firefighter. I am also an enabled citizen and greatly concerned with the pressing need for expanded OHP coverage for the disability community, of which I am a volunteer advocate. Last week, I was admitted into the Pro Bono College of the State Bar of Texas and for contributions to low-income people, mostly disabled, on a nationwide basis. You are here today to consider expanding care for disabled citizens under the age of 19, and I submit there is no doubt for the need for such expansion of the definition categorically needy. Disabled needy would almost seem to be redundancy. Scratch, almost. There also exists discrete insular minority of the disability population where the need is arguably even more dire. And I'm referring to the presumed gap in coverage between someone on Medicaid or OHP having applied for and received Social Security disability status, losing their OHP and having to wait 2 years before their Medicare vests, and they may receive their crucial medical care. And some of these people actually, probably a tiny number of them, are actually under the age of 19. Most such people caught in that pincer are receiving chronic care treatment and medications that equal or exceed their Social Security disability income. Where the need has already been formally acknowledged and confirmed again by Social Security, where is the sense or logic in denying them continuous care? Why cannot a person in this gap buy into OHP on the same terms as they pay for their Medicare package? Ironically, the amount of money one pays for such coverage is approximately the difference in income that is said to disqualify someone in this situation from OHP. Doesn't that boggle the mind? As this committee has already heard, this two-year gap, rather like something out of Alice in Wonderland, can lead to the direst consequences. Not 2 weeks ago, a woman appeared before this committee who had already been severely gored by the horns of this irrational dilemma. In the 2 years time between losing OHP and the vesting of her Medicare, essential treatment was foregone. Thousands in medical bills, primarily from the emergency room, were accumulated, and this woman's whole world seemingly fell like a house of cards. Allow me to share with you my situation. So 4 years ago, I had a major disagreement with a flying tree limb while fighting what became known as the B&B fire. It rang my bell in a pretty big way, but I sucked it in, and then later received some outpatient treatment for a chin abrasion that became infected. Weeks later, at Salem Hospital outpatient clinic, I apparently contracted a staph infection of the highly drug-resistant variety. A week later, I was in Good Sam being operated on, and the infection had spread to a hairline fracture of my chin, and I came within hours of dying. 18 days later, I was released from the hospital, and I can firmly say that my OHP coverage, still in force after a poor fire season for me, saved my life.
Numerous health factors forced me on Social Security disability 5 months later. My infection lay dormant for approximately 6 months, and then due to lack of regular treatment and timely medication, it acted up again. Over the next 2 years, I exhausted the OHP hearing process, obtained injunctions pro se, and proceeded to fight in the courts what I perceived as a cruel, unjust, and arguably misinterpreted regulations. I would not be alive today had I not possessed a few feeble skills and fierce determination and fought for my life through appeals all the way to the United States Supreme Court. Also, following the exhaustion of all that and just before I made it to the bell on Medicare, I had 14 admissions to the emergency room. Very expensive way to treat something which regular medical care could have seen to. As best I can ascertain a reading regarding their decisions to through it all, I argued that I thought I might be the child of a lesser God. I am not the child of a lesser law. The Oregon Supreme Court apparently disagreed, and the United States Supremes poured me out, denying me certiorari. Comment. As best I can ascertain regarding their decisions without opinion, I do so by extrapolating from the Attorney General's excellent brief, this issue is a legislative matter, not a judicial one. So, hello, legislature. Here I am after fighting my way this far to make this point. Never mind that I pointed out this unreasonable policy would put the state in the position of literally killing someone who was a dependent as a custodial prisoner or a vulnerable youth. The court's variance did not buy my argument that there is a right to health care to be found in the discerning reading in both the Oregon and the United States constitutions. At least a right to health care where one is already dependent on state assistance and one's life is endangered. Representative Greenlick, you have my unyielding admiration for proposing a constitutional amendment that clarifies that Oregon should indeed have such a right, and I eagerly await your reporting out the referral to the voters on such an amendment. But the legislation before us now immediately addresses the need for expanded definition of the categorically needy to include disabled citizens under the age of 19, a distinctly vulnerable cohort. Such considerations should also be extended to another equally vulnerable population, which are those who not once but twice have been administratively determined to be in need of medical assistance. Please end this ridiculous and dangerous 2-year coverage gap. I already fear I am the child of lesser God. Please don't tell me again that I am the child of a lesser law. Thank you, and God bless the state of Oregon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ware. Any questions? That I have to admit that 2-year thing sounds very strange. You get into a situation where, in order to qualify for OHP, you need to be below 72% of the poverty line if you're disabled and don't have a home health need, but your grant puts you at 84%. It just really does seem like a catch-22.
And the price of the price of buying into the Medicare is the difference in your income between eligibility. It boggles the mind.
Yeah, it's odd. Thank you very much. Yes, Ms. Kitchen.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, I'm Tina Kitchen. I'm the medical director for the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities. I think you have in front of you a bill that would move Oregon forward in its care for children with disabilities. I think it's a very important bill. However, I don't think it needs any mention to you folks, but it's not in the governor's recommended budget. However, we would be very happy to work...
Very little in the governor's recommended budget. Yes, I can make out.
Chair Greenlake, I agree with you. We would be very happy to work with you folks if we decide to change this bill. I'd like to correct one thing, and that is this is under federal legislation. If we create a program that meets the federal legislation, then it doesn't require a waiver. It is it would just be a state plan amendment. However, I think if we wanted to incorporate some of this within Healthy Kids, we could look at some different waivers that we could do that also. So,
I'm afraid I don't understand what you just said. Could you,
Could you run that
by us one more time?
Chair Greenlee, I'm sorry. There is federal legislation that authorizes this as a newly eligible Medicaid eligible group.
It's referenced in the bill, yeah.
It's federal legislation.
Right.
And if we obey the federal legislation, it doesn't require a waiver of their rules.
We just go ahead and do it.
We can put it into our state plan amendment, and it doesn't require a waiver.
But?
If we wanted to do something slightly outside of that, such as it requires that we do an SSI eligible level of determination for their disability, which is a very high standard, and as you heard, is not a very friendly process to go through. If we were to decide to do something less than that, it would require a waiver.
I see. The SSI determination is required for the federal program?
Correct.
That's what you're saying. If you want to do something else, then that requires an additional waiver. But we could seek that waiver, right?
Correct.
And both of them are matching funds at the same level?
Correct.
Okay. Gotcha. Representative Kotek, you have a question bursting inside you. I can see it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Kitchen, I just have a question on your third paragraph. It talks about House Bill 2445 requiring significant administrative supports and resources. I get the resource side of things, and many of us will work hard to figure out how to pay for this. What do you mean by administrative supports?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Kotek. I briefly mentioned that with requiring SSI level of determination.
So that's if we went with the SSI determination route.
Correct. We at the state would actually have to do that disability determination, which is fairly intensive and fairly administratively difficult to do.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
So with the recommendation of the department resources aside, your recommendation would be probably then to pursue a waiver to minimize some of the administrative burden that would come with doing the other route?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Kotek, I think it's pretty fair to say that the department would love to work with you folks to try to figure out a way that we can do this less costly and still serve these children in a way that would work.
Great. Thank you.
I'm still I'm still not sure I understand the implication of what we're talking about, so I think
neither do I. You're not alone.
What does the bill call for in your reading of the bill? Does it call for the existing program, or does it call for, would it require a waiver as it's written right now?
Chair Greenlee, I think the existing bill as it is written right now would meet the federal requirements of the Federal Opportunity Act, and it would not require a waiver.
But as it's written now, you think it would end up getting a fiscal because of a relatively higher fiscal because of the fact that it requires SSI disability determination?
Chair Greenlee, yes.
Have you proposed a fiscal yet to LFO on this?
Chair Greenlee, my understanding is of Friday they were working on the fiscal. I'm not quite sure if LFO has it this weekend or not.
Is this going to be a fiscal that means you don't like the bill, or a fiscal that means you do like the bill?
Chair Greenlee. We like the bill, Chair Greenlee. We like the bill.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
So we don't need to worry about it. Well, I think we do need to, because
yes, you will get what
we've been instructed to pay attention to.
Once and again, to review the procedure, the red flag for fiscal that generates or amps up their speed is when they see the schedule for a work session. Unless we specifically ask for a fiscal, we generally will not get a fiscal on a public hearing. But when they see a work session, they know that then we're there'll be some deliberation and they'll start generating. This particular bill, even with the prior reference, we will get what they are referring to as a fiscal light, which will be a outline of the fiscal impact that then the agency will provide to fiscal, and we'll get something, just not the full detail that Ways and Means will go into.
Well, I'd like I'd like to prepare this for, that's right, we have a Ways and Means boss here. So
I'm just trying, I want to make sure I'm giving the right info.
You want to comment on?
I think we could simplify this considerably by an amendment to House Bill 2009 that would request the department to pursue a waiver to cover this categorically eligible population and leave the details up to them. And
yeah, I'd like to have it for both routes. Would you help Representative Gelzer get an amendment for 2009? I'd like to keep it alive, so if this turns out to be the best way to handle it, we'll be able to handle it either way.
Okay.
Does that work for you? Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, yeah.
Just a quick question. What's the federal match on this? Is this standard Medicaid federal match, or are we looking at something different under this?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Cannon, this would be the standard Medicaid match,
which is getting better every day.
Hopefully, assuming that the president signs, we'll get better, but not good enough.
Thanks.
It's better tomorrow.
It'll be better for a year or two. Dr. Kitchen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. We'll begin moving on these in one form or another. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, no, I was just showing you the
First let me close the first public hearing on HB 2445. Do we have any committee bills to be introduced today?
Not today, Mr. Chair.
Not today, okay. Well, then, I will adjourn the House Committee early. Should we have the Vice Chair's